I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Well, thanks very much for that introduction. That's done half of my work already, actually. But I just wanted to start very briefly by talking about some work that I did about 10 years ago. So I've been writing as a journalist about the far right since 2008 or 2009. And around this time, a decade ago, I was having to go to the British Library's Rare Books and Manuscripts room to call up restricted material from its special archives, which are, you know, basically include right-wing extremism and pornography, and read this right-wing extremist material under security cameras, under the watch of, you know, the British Library security staff and librarians. And that was the only way that I, at that time, could find out about some of the key concepts that were driving the far right in Britain and elsewhere. And I was reading, you know, about how groups like the BNP and other smaller extremist groups at that time had kept alive ideas that went back to the 1920s, 1930s, fascism, anti-Semitic conspiracy theory, profound racism, authoritarian ideas, and so on and so on, and how they were trying to reinvent that for the 21st century. You know, so one of the things the BNP was talking about in its internal publications at that time was, let's stop talking about race and start talking about identity and culture and defending our culture and defending our identity, and, you know, that we just want to keep our culture separate, and so on and so on. And having done that at that time, it's been a really unsettling experience for me over the last 10 years to see how this stuff has moved from these very niche areas that you would have to either go into archives to look up, or visit websites that were essentially just print magazines placed online, to seeing this stuff circulate globally and be driving some of the major global news stories of our time, to see some of those concepts and ideas circulated not just by people on the fringes, but by the President of the United States, you know, and so on and so on. And I think Yulia Ebner's book, Going Dark, is a really, really important contribution in helping us understand how that's happened. What are the ideas driving not just far-right extremist groups, but other groups today? And how we can better understand it in order to protect ourselves, I think. So I'd just like to start off by asking Yulia a bit about the experience of researching and writing the book. So when you started out on this project, what initially were you in search of?
I think what really motivated me to spend time within extremist movements was that, of course, we at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, for example, we use a lot of very sophisticated data analysis tools, and we can trace back pieces of disinformation, look for their origins. We can look at how big a campaign, a radicalization campaign, gets, how it gains traction across various social media platforms. But it was very hard to penetrate some of the more hidden corners where actually some of the internal discussions were happening, some of the strategic discussions, and also where most of the indoctrination processes happen. I really wanted to see more of the human dimension and of the social dynamics within these groups, both online, but also in a sense get a feeling for what drives people, what drives the real people behind these accounts, and what motivates them to stay within these groups.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, the groups we're talking about, they're not just white supremacist and neo-Nazi groups, but quite a wider range. So some of the groups that you're involved in investigating include Christian fundamentalist fundamentalist groups linked to ISIS, sort of extreme misogynist groups online of various sorts. I suppose the first thing I wanted to ask about there really is that I think you found there was that kind of common thread between them in the way that people were socialised into those groups. Like what drew people to these extremist corners of the internet, and then the kind of communities they found in there.
It was quite shocking to see how much of the whole radicalization process was more about, not really about the ideological component, but really more about feeling part of a community and being socialized into almost different subcultures. I would also say that all of these groups that I investigated were so different in terms of their insider references, jokes, even that they sometimes even developed their own language, as we could see with the Christchurch attacker and the attackers that we had in the US recently in Poway and El Paso, but also in Halle at the synagogue shooting in Germany. They all spoke a very similar language, and you can see a pattern that they come from the same kind of online networks. And it was really shocking to see that this was kind of a pattern within all of these groups, that that creating this counterculture feeling, this almost this youth internet culture, was the main part of the radicalization process, I would say. And some individuals, especially some really young members, also were drawn into these groups without really being ideologically, without really having even a political opinion before that. And some just were motivated by the sense of community or by the gamification elements.
So I just like to take it back a step there into the sort of those initial steps that some people take getting involved in one or other of these communities. And what comes through in the book quite strongly is it's often sort of people looking for a sense of belonging.
Yeah.
And, you know, they don't quite know why they've headed in this particular direction, but what comes through is this desire to be accepted by your peers within this, you know, quite niche environment. And the thing that really stuck out for me was in your discussion of the white supremacist internet forums, where there's this real pressure to state your racial purity. And so there's a bit in Yulia's book where, I mean, you have to kind of pass this test where they quiz you about your heritage and encourage you to take a DNA test and then post the results in the forum to show that you're, you know, kind of pure Aryan stock or whatever. But what really stuck with me is how, obviously, because this is true for most of us, nobody is pure in that sense genetically. And you have all of these wannabe white supremacists who are saying, well, actually, I've got this heritage or that heritage. And then you see the forum members get into these contortions about how, well, that we'll still accept you, or, you know, how can we accept this person even though they don't fit?
Yeah, that was some of the vetting procedures or some of the recruiting processes were really quite crazy, and they actually got more and more rigid as we saw more security forces also infiltrating some of these channels, especially after the Charlottesville rally in the US in 2017, and especially after some of these threats were taken more seriously and you had more journalists going into some of these groups. They introduced things like some even had demanded things that would really cross, for example, my moral boundaries, where I would not do that. For example, taking part in a recruitment campaign was something I would not do. But things like submitting a picture of my hand wrist to prove that I'm white with the logo of the group, or showing the results of a DNA test, which, as you say, some white supremacists also in the process of finding out that they actually also had non-white heritage or were from a migrant background, were that also caused some kind of psychological or discrepancy or almost cognitive dissonance about this, and where they started to question themselves in some cases, and in other cases they still adhered to the ideologies and still continued to believe in conspiracy theories, for example, linked to these genetic tests. So they were all finding all kinds of justifications of why maybe the test results are screwed.
Mm-hmm. And while we're still on the topic of the specifically online communities, I think another important aspect of it is the way that kind of group solidarity, for want of a better word, is quite strictly enforced. And I'm thinking now about the groups that you studied involving women in particular, where one of them is this Tradwives movement, which is, I think, partly Christian fundamentalist and partly linked to the kind of online men's rights, misogynist movement as well, where, you know, they, within those scenes, there are people kind of, it's kind of very detailed sort of form of indoctrination. You know, there are step-by-step guides into how to red pill yourself, how to become the kind of woman that these groups are asking you to be. I just wondered if you talk a bit about that, first of all.
Yeah, to be honest, this was one case of radicalization that I had never come across before that in my work. I'd looked at mostly jihadist groups, at neo-Nazi and white supremacist groups, but I hadn't really encountered any female anti-feminists or female misogynists. I'd even looked at the bigger manosphere movement, which is kind of a mosaic of different misogynist subcultures, some more extreme than others, mainly on the internet. And this subcommunity was really, I think, one of the most shocking I've seen in terms of how the radicalization takes place, because it's a different kind of radicalization, because these women rather develop almost a hatred towards themselves instead of a hatred towards a demonized outgroup. And it was also one of the first movements where I could feel that I could identify with some of the topics they addressed and they discussed. For example, of course, like some of the double burden issues that we face in today's modern world as women, but also hookup culture, online dating apps, or things like that were discussed as kind of challenges and burdens for women and how to deal with those. And they gave easy solutions to that, which was kind of a return to a distant past in which women don't have anything to say. Literally, they had the shut the fuck up method, as they call it, which is, according to them, the success recipe for any healthy relationship, to not talk back if you're verbally abused. And this is kind of where it started. So some of them, as you said, some of them were purely just very ultra-conservative, but some of them were actually also endorsing domestic violence and were feeding into this bigger misogynist subculture, where you could even see, for example, the incel subculture within that that manosphere movement also inspired terrorist attacks against women, and where they were really fostering or feeding into that hatred. And one female influencer of this traditional wives community, she also gives instructions, for example, for men on how to red pill their girlfriends or wives into believing in these ideologies. Red pilling is a reference to the Matrix, because it's kind of fused by the far right and by the alt right, especially to as a reference to the red pill that people take in the Matrix, and all of a sudden they see the world as it truly is. So it's kind of a euphemism for radicalization.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's something in that as well about, I know, other groups that you write about talk about this more explicitly, but like it's made into a kind of game as well. There's this sense of, you know, you enter this online community, and then there are like kind of levels you can achieve within it. You know, you kind of follow these steps and you will get to the next level and, you know, prove your skill or prove that you understand it better than the last. But I guess also I'm just thinking about the way kind of boundaries are enforced around it. There's this, I don't know, I think what's really valuable about this book is because you've gone into these groups in this way, you let us see what initially can be very welcoming for people drawn to them. So, yeah, I mean, you know, talking about the trad wives movement, you know, it's kind of partly presenting itself as an escape from some of the pressures of patriarchy in the 21st century, for example.
Yeah.
Or, you know, kind of lost young white men finding this community of people that say, actually, you know, you belong and you're more important than you think you are and the rest of it. But then on the other side, there's this very hard edge to it where the boundaries are actually very strictly enforced. And I was thinking in particular of what you write about the so-called jihadi brides scene of women who have been drawn to the Islamic State, you know, in kind of supporting roles that, you know, it's got an overlap with the trad wives movement, for example, but that when the group is under threat, they cut members loose or they, you know, shut down the barriers very, very quickly, which must also be quite a common way of behaving.
Exactly. This is quite a common pattern. This is also the case, for example, in the white nationalist movement, Generation Identity, They are very selective already in the recruitment procedures, but they also, if one member oversteps any boundaries, any rules, because they have quite a standardized branding strategy across all the countries they operate in. They have branches all across Europe and also now in the UK and Ireland. And when one member doesn't play by the rules, they are quick to kick them out. Or when one member becomes a burden in terms of reputation or image. And that's the same also for example, I was also in the organization teams behind the Charlottesville rally. And they even, in these organization chat groups, they even called on individuals to assess their own kind of their own outward appearance and said, if you're obese, if you're not looking hip or cool enough, if you think, be honest to yourself, then just don't join the protest, because we want to portray a good image of ourselves and attract new members. And so that was also something where I couldn't, at first I actually couldn't believe that they were so discriminatory towards their own members, towards their own sympathizers in a sense.
Actually, I was going to ask you about something else, but I'll hold it for a minute, because mm-hmm. Charlottesville is a good point to talk about the relationship between this online set of subcultures and what happens offline.
Yeah.
So perhaps for audience members who aren't totally familiar with Charlottesville, do you want to just explain what that event was and it's the way it related mm-hmm. to what you were studying?
I think Charlottesville was really one of the turning points, because in the mobilization of the international alt-right, or especially the US white nationalist networks, because before that we'd seen kind of in the run-up to the US election, to the Trump election especially, all these different subcultures gaining ground and also cooperating more and more, especially running campaigns, pro-Trump campaigns. So you had, for example, the racist part and anti-immigration parts of the alt-right community and the anti-Semitic parts. But then you also had the conspiracy theory networks, the misogynist networks, some kind of gaming overlaps here as well. And all these subcultures came together already in the Trump election. And then Charlottesville in 2017 was the first occasion where they actually strategically were planning to take this whole movement offline, to launch a first protest in the real world, to bring this resistance, as they call it, to life in a sense, and also to create a first step for more protests to follow. And they took they also planned, for example, most of their campaigns both online and live streamed some of the footage from the protests on the bigger platforms, but they also coordinated everything on the gaming chat application Discord. And I was in those groups already in the lead up, I think a month or even 6 weeks before that, you could see that this was going to be a violent protest. And then I actually decided not to go there, because I felt too afraid that after so many members had posted weapons, and of course in the US they chose Charlottesville because of the quite loose weapons regulations there. And in the end, a counter-protester got killed, Heather Heyer. She was overrun by one of the protesters in a car that he drove into the protesters' crowd. So I think it was definitely also a turning point when looking at how the security services and policymakers, not the Trump administration, but in general policymakers across the world, were, how seriously they were taking these online subcultures. And in the last few years, I think we've seen some of these subcultures gain traction, some of them kind of splintered into different groups, but it was definitely a turning point.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, to many people outside of that world, it was a shock, obviously, to see this happen so prominently. I wonder how you felt about it at the time. Did it? I mean, obviously, because you've worked on extremism and these kind of groups for years and years, was there anything kind of new about the way that developed in the wake of Trump's election that surprised you?
It was strange to see anti-Semitic kind of far-right sympathizers run next to the counter-jihadist movement, which in general would be rather actually pro-Zionist and which would have not previously cooperated. So you had all these different sections of the far-right, or also paleo-conservative far-right individuals running next to the ultra-libertarian far-right parts. So counterpart. So it was almost an opportunistic get-together for these different fractions within the far right, but they knew that by cooperating and by staging this protest together, they could have more leverage and more, have a megaphone, especially also in the online world. Mm. So that was definitely one of the first things, and also some really extreme groups, like, for example, Andrew Anglin's Daily Stormer community, that's a neo-Nazi website in the US, they launched quite big campaigns, and sometimes they were tailoring different audiences with a lot of very skillfully kind of orchestrated campaigns. You could see that they were adopting the language of the communities they wanted to go into. It was almost a bit like when ISIS launched some of the propaganda campaigns. You could see that they were very carefully thinking about how to target these different communities.
Mm. Yeah, and actually this goes back to what I was talking about briefly in my introduction, actually, the kind of difference. I guess the question of what's changed, why has this all come to a head now, in the last few years, that until quite recently, maybe sort of 5-10 years ago, my impression is that among kind of the far right, there were these quite clear divisions between groups with different beliefs, you know, that anybody who wanted to pursue a far-right political project that had any chance of winning widespread support or even minor support had to distance themselves from anti-Semitism, for example. So even when they may have well fully believed in anti-Semitic conspiracy theory themselves, and the BNP are a good example of that. So, you know, they're Britain's most successful ever far-right political party. The people in charge of that have got their roots in the most extreme bits of the British far-right. You know, the people who ran the party, their core beliefs were neo-Nazi, and they believed in all of this, but they knew that they would have no hope of winning votes if any of that came above the surface, and put a lot of effort into hiding those beliefs and targeting things that had potentially more widespread appeal, such as anti-Islam bigotry. And then you had kind of the newer wave of far-right movements that came after that seemed to have left all of that completely behind. So something like the English Defence League, which emerged in 2009, its key players from the outset sort of actually deliberately cast themselves against the old school anti-Semitic far right. They would fly Israel flags at their demonstrations to show, you know, solidarity with Israel as a way of attacking Muslims, essentially. And, you know, were very focused on kind of Islamophobic themes that were present in mainstream media. But then what seems to have happened very, very rapidly, at least in the way that I've observed it, is that the walls between these things have completely collapsed, or at least to a certain extent. And something like Charlottesville, I think, is one of those moments that
there are definitely made that rallying points that are considered as strategically important, critical junctions where they do opportunistically cooperate, and where you can see them overcoming these ideological differences and also the geographic distances and working together as a global movement. But I think also in the past couple of years, we've again seen some fragmentation among, for example, the more anti-Semitic alt-right and the alt-right that is rather the counter-jihadist, kind of focusing on anti-Muslim and anti-immigrant rhetoric. But usually their lowest common denominator is their hatred of migrants, their hatred of Muslims, and their hatred of the liberal left. And that's something where they do find a lowest common denominator to build on for some of these campaigns.
Mm-hmm. So maybe a better way of seeing it in that case is that developments in technology and the developments of these various online subcultures have gave an opportunity for these groups to try and sort of unify and unite and do something strong, but actually their differences remained, and that has made it very unstable, and that you know, people fall out as much as they try to form something bigger and more united.
Exactly. It's also interesting when looking at the last few attacks, the last terrorist attacks that we've only seen in 2019. With Christchurch, the perpetrator attacked mosques, so that was clearly an anti-Muslim kind of act. But in his manifesto, he referenced the Great Replacement Theory, this idea that the white European populations are gradually being replaced with non-whites. And so this conspiracy theory is really seen across all of these different, across the whole spectrum in the far-right communities. And then in Poway, the perpetrator in the U.S. close to San Diego attacked the synagogue. And the same was true for Pittsburgh. That was also against the synagogue. And both of them also had the Great Replacement theory as elements of inspiration. But they took it one level kind of further and gave or blamed the global Jewish elites for this gradual replacement. So you can see different layers to these conspiracy theories inspiring actions and terrorist actions and violence against different demonized communities and different enemies.
Which also sort of bringing me back to that question of what's changed, like what I was saying earlier about some very, we were talking about this before we came upstairs, that often when you look at these groups, it's a very puzzling mix of some extremely innovative ideas and then some very old and unchanging ones. And this, that conspiracy theory, very often in the media, this idea of the Great Replacement is talked about as if it's a kind of new, you know, some completely brand new far-right conspiracy theory. But, yeah. I mean, really, since the Second World War, in Europe at least, the kind of central conspiracy theory that's driven the most extreme far-right movements has been that, you know, there's a global Jewish conspiracy to bring non-white immigration into white-majority countries and thereby dilute the white race and the rest of it. And this is a kind of new articulation of that. But sort of technology is playing a particular role there in maybe accelerating it or giving it more prominence.
Yeah, you can, and also some of the anti-Semitic tropes and even today's memes, which back then we didn't have, but they still resemble, of course, the original anti-Semitic tropes, and they try to sometimes make them more seem more legitimate or even funny by turning them into visually appealing content. And I think that's also one of the dangers of these online gaming cultures, that a lot of it becomes so blurry in terms of where is the line between what's still satirical, kind of funny elements of memes and of these subcultures, and especially these trolling boards that originally weren't even political, like 4chan in the early 2000s, was just really about transgressing social boundaries, breaking taboos, and now it's become definitely a hotbed for radicalization. And it's very difficult sometimes to really even show that this is still carrying these quite old ideological elements or these conspiracy theories that are just conveyed in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, there was a phrase that jumped out at me from your book that relates this in your discussion of this movement, Generation Identity, where you quote them as saying that we want to turn resistance into a game.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, for a bit of context, Generation Identity, I mean, you can correct me if I get this wrong, but they're kind of a fairly a newish far-right movement that's at least has attempted to be pan-European. They grew out of a subsection of the French far right, but links back to an earlier shift that I was talking about with reference to the BNP, which was that in the 80s and the 90s, a lot of the old school far right parties said, well, we need to kind of reframe our ideas and we'll stop talking about race and start talking about identity and how we're just trying to defend identity. And that, you know, that the BNP's rhetoric was suffused with this, you know, during the whole period when they were winning council seats across England, two of their candidates were elected to the European Parliament. It was on exactly that kind of rhetoric. And then that kind of had a revival in the last few years through this Generation Identity movement, which managed to reframe it as being a kind of youth counterculture, which the BNP most definitely weren't, because it was middle-aged and older men in suits, effectively. And I just wondered if you could talk us through sort of how those groups did that. I mean, how do they kind of make this stuff fun and make it seem like a game?
It's a mixture of different things. They use, so on the one hand, they also, it starts with language. They use euphemisms like, for example, ethno-pluralism to essentially describe ethnic separatism. But then they also gamify their whole, from recruitment, propaganda, and then even as we could see in the terrorist attacks, acts of terrorism have now become gamified. For example, the neo-Nazi trolling army, but also some of these generation identity trolling groups or online groups, the way that they operate is often through scoring systems where, for example, members can gain points if they launch a particularly successful campaign against political opponents. And Reconquista Germanica was one of the biggest trolling armies that I joined. And you had to, so they had at a certain point, there was a Germany-based neo-Nazi trolling group on the gaming application Discord. And to join, you had to go through interview processes. But then once you joined, you were designated a rank in almost like a military-like structure. So you were on the lowest strategic level when you entered as a kind of foot soldier. And you had generals, and you could be promoted by basically spending your entire spare time attacking political opponents or helping out in some of these online raids or doing what they called, they even had military language for some of their online operations. So, for example, a sniper mission would be targeting a specific enemy that they would select online with hate and threat campaigns. And then also they would hijack hashtags to influence political discussions, for example, in the run-up, especially to the German elections, they did that. And the Supreme Commander, he even framed this whole thing as a game, but he also said, almost to give them an incentive to play the game, once we get into power, you will also we will make sure that these structures are reflected in the real world, and that if you're in a higher rank, you will also this will be mirrored in kind of the real world once we,
Mm-hmm. And that's that links nicely to what I was going to ask you about next, actually, which is that just as a kind of final aspect of your, you know, what it was like to do the work on, to do this kind of research undercover, is that your undercover work was not only online, but it took you offline into meetings with some of the people in these groups. And I think your meetings with networks of generation identity activists were very revealing in that respect. And I just wonder if you could just talk us a bit through like what you learned from doing that.
Yeah, to be honest, I didn't plan initially. I didn't actually plan to do these offline undercover encounters as well. So it was more something where I again felt like I was hitting a wall in these online conversations, and I really wanted to know what's happening in the real world as well, and how this is connected to the online space. And Generation Identity, I think, was one of the groups where this was most interesting to see how much of their really sophisticated online campaigns are, how much planning there is behind it and how much strategy. Because so I went to their launch of their UK and Ireland branch, because I saw in some of these online groups and some of these encrypted chat apps that they were planning to set up a branch in the UK. And actually their Austrian movement, I'm Austrian, and their Austrian movement and also the German one, they're quite influential. The Generation Identity was originally founded in France, but they've spread across Europe. And I also wanted to prevent them from being able to tap into youth movements and recruit a lot of young people in the UK. So I kind of wanted to know what their plans are. And so I was, I reached out to them and pretended to be an exchange student, an Austrian exchange student in the UK. And so I went through several recruiting procedures, also met one of their leading identitarians in Vienna, and then was invited to their initial strategy meeting, first in a pub in Mayfair, and then the next day was in an Airbnb in Brixton. And they had influencers and leaders from the European groups come to London, actually, to brief the new members on how to best do the branding, on how to best run a campaign, on what to say when they're asked tricky questions by journalists, how to respond, for example, to the question, are you anti-Semitic? Are you racist? And they had a very almost standardized briefing of communication strategies, and were using actually sometimes even scientific studies to back that up, or even evidence from marketing studies, where they said, for example, it's all about strategic polarization, so really staging breakthrough acts, as they call it, or probably more like media stunts that would attract attention, that would be explicitly provocative and be kind of at the verge of being socially unacceptable, but that's in order to split the population and in order to make them take a side, either for in their favor or against them, but so that they could, by doing that, create more of a movement toward political change. And this
again is a kind of, in one respect, a kind of well-worn idea on the far right, like that Jean-Marie Le Pen of the Front National was kind of known as the sort of pioneer of doing that, of deliberately saying offensive things that would cause a backlash and force people to take one side or another.
Yeah.
But this is using kind of new techniques by sort of organising online, but then, I mean, I feel this gets a bit overemphasized by the press when they cover these movements, but making it seem young and part of youth culture and the rest of it.
Yeah, that's something that Generation Identity does really well. And as I said earlier, they even, when they choose, for example, the public faces for their campaigns, they even consider things like age or how good does this person look. So they would, in the UK, they didn't let one or even two members be their public faces because they considered them as being too old. Mm-hmm. And that was something I didn't really know, that they were so strategic about it. But it's also, in regards to that strategic polarization tactic, that's, of course, also something that we find on all sides of the political fringes, and that actually jihadist movements, we usually then call it management of savagery, where they also try to provoke as much chaos as possible and drive communities apart in order to basically change the power dynamics.
Yeah, which... Yeah, I mean, brings me on to another area of conversation, really, which is that, I mean, how much that we can find out about these kind of extremist groups mm-hmm. is just really a way that wider politics now works. You know, how much are they doing something innovative with technology, or actually are we kind of all behaving in this way as well when we use social media or form communities online and the rest of it?
Yeah, that's the biggest challenge, I think, right now is that, of course, the way that the algorithms work and the way that the business models are designed, they try to make users stay on the platform as long as possible. So they try to capture our attention. But the problem is that what captures our attention tends to be violent content, extremist content, even conspiracy theories. And also the people that spend most time online, on YouTube, for example, would usually be addicted people, people who believe in conspiracy theories, people with extremist views, and those are the ones that get to train the algorithms for us, for all of us. So the content that would then be automatically recommended by YouTube or also by other social media platforms would often tend to get more and more extreme, and you quickly get down a rabbit hole, even if you have a neutral account. So that's really ingrained in the, or that's one of the problems really inherent to the business models of the social media platforms and basically of most tech platforms that want to maximize attention.
Yeah, I mean, for those reasons, there's a lot of anger expressed at those social media platforms. But as somebody who works on what to do about this stuff as well as identifying it and describing it, what realistically could these large tech platforms be doing to improve that situation?
Some of them have already taken some initial action, but the problem is, so we talk a lot also at the Institute for Strategic Dialogue, we work a lot with kind of at the intersection of policy, but also with the tech firms. We try to give them advice on how to prevent people from getting radicalized on their platforms. They don't always take the advice, but they have already taken some steps. But the problem is that proactively, there's only so much that they do, and that's usually to have a damage limitation in terms of their reputation or to respond to new regulation or to political action. So it's usually quite responsive and rather than proactive. I think what effectively should happen and what is already kind of in the process right now, in the UK there's a white paper on online harms, which hopefully will kind of put more responsibility onto the platforms to make them more accountable for the content that they do prioritize with their algorithms. In France, there is also a new law that really tries to enhance visibility the visibility or the transparency of how the algorithms work and why people are being suggested certain content or are being recommended certain content. And in Germany, you have anti-hate speech laws, which have been a good start, but also meant that a lot of the satirical content or even news reporting content was accidentally taken down in the beginning. So you do have implementation problems because it's really hard to train the algorithms to be very precise in those gray zone areas. Ultimately, we definitely need to take down some of these really violent contents. It can't be the case that after Christchurch or even after the last attack in Thailand, these live streamed violent videos stay online for hours and are being re-uploaded. And there is definitely an international approach that's needed because as we had the global coalition against ISIS, for example, which really was a coalition of countries across the world working together and removing ISIS propaganda materials. We don't really have anything similar for far-right extremist content or even for far-right terrorist groups. There is no international strategy because we don't even have a definition of what, or we don't even agree on a definition of what far-right terrorist movements would be. And they function, as you said, in a much more loose kind of network form rather than traditionally organized, locally rooted groups. So there are lots of challenges. And ultimately, I don't believe that we can take down everything that's harmful or even radicalizing. I think we really need to have better intervention strategies, especially for some of these fringe platforms where also the Christchurch and the other terrorist attackers radicalize themselves, which aren't really being given much attention at the moment. There's a whole world of really extreme fringe platforms where we don't have any online intervention programs to bring people back and out of these networks.
And I think another aspect of the problem that you get at towards the end of the book is that, you know, there are, you know, in one respect, this is a problem of these huge global profit-making companies that have grown up around these platforms, and you have national governments trying to deal with this thing that they maybe don't quite understand and, you know, has no respect for borders or any of the ways in which, you know, national governments would traditionally try and regulate an issue. But at the same time, this is a relatively new form of communication that all of us are using without really fully understanding. And that I was very interested in what you had to say about the other side of it, which is how the kind of tools that individuals can develop as they use social media platforms or other things online to deal with this. And what really summed that up for me is that you have a chapter about hackers and, you know, very sophisticated hacking networks that are linked to far-right extremist groups or other kind of malicious groups online. And there's a post you quote that one of the kind of prominent hackers says, okay, here are the basic things you need to know to kind of get on in this world. And I mean, it's, you know, learn C22, learn just a little bit of x86 assembler, learn JavaScript, work through Hacking the Art of Exploitation by Ericsson, and so on and so on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to the majority of people, that's a completely baffling list.
Yeah.
And perhaps suggests that, you know, as an individual internet user, you're going to be at a loss in this very technologically sophisticated environment. So, but it's not as bad as that makes it sound, I think, you're trying to get at towards the end of the book, because there are various kind of tools and ways of thinking about it we can all sort of develop and encourage. So I just wondered if you could explain those a bit.
One of the problems is that even some of, and this is actually still quite low skill hacking that some of these extremist groups are doing, and even that can cause a lot of damage. But then there are also other campaigns, intimidation campaigns that can have a big effect without really having to be technologically savvy, without even having to be a big group of people. If you coordinate a campaign in an encrypted messaging app, you can launch a really disproportionately loud campaign, and get a megaphone by tricking the algorithms. I do think, and that's also why in the solutions chapter, I present some innovative initiatives that we're already seeing across the world, where civil society campaigners have founded their own, for example, counter-trolling armies or their own help networks for people who are, for example, a network called Hate Aid for people who are being targeted by such intimidation campaigns or threat campaigns. And we have seen death threats, sexual threats being targeted also in the UK, most recently against British MPs, but also journalists, especially female journalists, faced that a lot and also even researchers, artists. I think it is really a challenge that is increasing and has become much more urgent in the last few years. So we'll hopefully see more of such campaigns. And it's, in the end, it's also about fostering both kind of digital citizenship or a sense of being, having digital, having civil courage, but also in the digital space. Because often we see campaigns and everyone sees that someone's being targeted, and yet no one steps in. And I think there is also a sense of
What would that mean in practice then? So, like, you know, digital citizenship is a very noble sounding phrase, but like, what are the ways that, say, people when they leave here this evening could start thinking differently about how they use the internet, for example?
I guess one of the main things is civil courage, as you would step in if you see someone being discriminated or shouted at or insulted on the tube, to also step in the online space, because actually there's even a lower risk to it, but the effect that one can have by helping someone online is quite big. And often the people who run some of these campaigns or who participate in the campaigns also don't really think about don't really grasp the fact that there's a human person behind the account. So there's often, and also the bystanders sometimes don't think about other users in real terms. So it's easier to look away, but I think getting back this human sense, and actually how much people do feel that their online presence has an impact on their real life, I think is important. So,
There are even some attempts, as you mentioned, to kind of organize that kind of response as well, mm-hmm. aren't there? Estonia that had?
They have the Baltic Elves, which fight the Russian trolls. So they fight disinformation, and it's a really promising campaign or a promising network that could also come to other European countries. They have in Lithuania, Estonia, and Latvia. In varying sizes, people spent their spare time debunking Russian disinformation and launching counter campaigns. But that's a civil society initiative, which also tends to have much more credibility than any kind of top-down government-led campaigns. And in Germany, there is a campaign called Ich bin hier. It originated, I think, from a Swedish my Swedish isn't good, so I have no idea actually what it's in Swedish, but it was originally a Swedish campaign. And they basically, whenever a newspaper article is flooded with negative comments, for example, anti-migrant or anti-refugee comments, especially in Germany and in Sweden, that's huge, or also anti-Muslim comments, they would step in and coordinate a more positive response. So coordinate posting positive comments about the article and then give each other likes on Facebook, so that then brings their comments on top of everyone else's comments. And by that, they almost bury the negative comments in the depths of the algorithms, basically. So the first thing that comes up is positive rather than negative. And I think in terms of also influencing the overall atmosphere online, because it's become so polarized and so hateful, and especially in the UK also with Brexit, it's just so divided. Everything seems so divided and so negative that I think this could be a really good initiative also.
It sounds like what you're saying as well is that I think for a lot of people the temptation in the face of all of that is to kind of disengage and switch off, to just assume that everything on, you know, all comments on the internet are trash and you shouldn't go anywhere near them.
Yeah.
But actually this sounds like a bit of a call not to do that and to actually see a value in engaging all the same, perhaps with some organization around it. That seems
On the mainstream platforms, on the bigger platforms, that's definitely the case. I also just thought there is actually also an English branch of that. They're called I Am Here, hashtag I Am Here. I wouldn't recommend the normal users to go onto the fringe, the really nasty neo-Nazi forums and start intervening there. I don't think that makes any sense. I think that's probably best done by professionally trained intervention providers. But in the normal, like in the daily life kind of online conversations and debates that are happening, I do think that there's a huge value in getting back these conversations by showing that actually some of the people who spread these really hostile comments are in the minority and just being given a megaphone by the way that the algorithms promote their content.
Mm-hmm. And we've got just a few minutes left now, so I just wanted to ask two final questions. The first is if you could give us a few predictions. I know you get to that at the end of your book. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, this is a moment where people might be quite worried and uncertain about these new developments. You know, you've seen some quite disturbing things emerge over the last few years that have translated into offline, you know, political developments, mass shootings, the rest of it. How is that all likely to change over the years to come?
One of the things that I'd like to see more is that's kind of half replying to your question, but is people in the space of counter-extremism and the security forces, policymakers who deal with these issues, looking more at the next technological innovations, because extremists always are early adopters of technologies, of innovations. And I think especially things like AI-based tools like deepfakes could become a huge asset to them for spreading disinformation, for actually manipulating entire videos. Now it's on the positive side, it's used for synchronizing movies, for really making people seem to say different things from what they're saying, which can be helpful if people speak a different language. But it can also be used to manipulate what Barack Obama is saying or what Merkel is saying. And you can, in retrospect, manipulate any kind of footage, but the same is true for text-based tools. You can create a text that looks, from the syntax, looks as if a famous journalist has written it, and in fact, it's a fake. And I think some of those developments, but also, of course, looking at hacking, at doxing, at phenomenons like that, and seeing how we can tackle those, I think the other things that are only covered when I consulted 10 different counterterrorism experts in one of the last chapters are things to also bear in mind, that of course now we're seeing kind of a resurgence of far-right extremists, of misogynist extremists. Jihadism is still a topic, but there might also be other players in the future. I do think that the misogynist communities, they are definitely gaining ground, or they are becoming bigger and more influential. So I would see that as a potential for future mobilization. In general, I would say there are two different challenges that lie ahead. To be honest, I'm quite pessimistic for the short run, but I'm also very optimistic about the medium and long term. I think those two challenges are, on the one hand, more of the kind of violence that we saw in the last year, especially gamified terrorism, terrorist attacks that are that come in a similar shape and form as we had those ISIS-inspired terrorist attacks, a form of copycat terrorism, a form of inspirational terrorism given by those networks, by these really loose international networks where the attackers are always glorified and people try to repeat the game, essentially. The game, it's not really a game, but the gamified terrorism act. And on the other hand, the political mainstreaming of some of these ideologies. Already, as you said, we've seen Trump, we've seen political front runners across Europe mentioned, for example, or giving air to Great Replacement and other conspiracy theories, and using the language, the memes of the far right and the alt right, and the fact that this can be coupled with really sophisticated disinformation campaigns, like using deepfakes, I think this might also lead to a normalization of some of this and the mainstreaming. Mm-hmm.
And then, just finally, I wanted to bring it back to what we were talking about at the outset, which is the particular work that you did to research the book. And I was just interested, sort of personally for you, you know, obviously you had to spend a lot of time immersed in these scenes, going undercover, but sort of putting on fake identities, including wearing a blonde wig at one point, I think, when you went to meet people. And I just wondered, sort of, what were your kind of ethical lines as you did that?
So at all points, I would not do anything that would help them with their recruitment campaigns or the propaganda campaigns. I was, of course, asked also when joining, for example, Generation Identity, do you want to be the public face of a campaign? Could you help us with translating these materials from German into English? Things like that. I did make promises, to be honest, but I didn't do it. And I did my very best to protect the identity of non-public individuals. I think it's a very, it's of course a very sensitive area. There were some, there were definitely also some moments where I did emphasize with individuals and where it was difficult to draw a line, to not step in the moment and, for example, debunk a conspiracy theory or try to get them out of the movement, because I could see that they were young and just, joining the movement without really knowing what they were doing. But in those cases, I thought it's more valuable to kind of collect the information to then provide hopefully enough grounds for more, for bigger campaigns or bigger intervention programs that are then also carried out by people who are more focusing on that, or who are professionally trained psychologists.
I mean, did you also find yourself liking people, you know, despite their views?
Yeah, of course. And I mean, there were so many moments where I even forgot that they were that they were propagating these really vile and nasty ideologies. There were, of course, moments of... But these were also the moments that gave me hope, because it's exactly seeing those human dimensions, even among the most extreme of extremists, that make you believe that intervention at any stage of the radicalization process and de-radicalization is possible by using those human dimensions as a starting point.
Yeah, and I think... I mean, this is a good point to conclude on, really, because I think we're just about out of time. I think this is what's so valuable about this book as well, is that you don't just sort of help us understand how one might intervene, you know, as an individual or a government trying to make policy to get people out of these circles, but what it is that it helps you understand what would attract people in the first place, because you're able to put yourself in their shoes and let readers do that as well. And I mean, to me, it's... what it comes down to is this idea of community. I mean, that's in all of the cases, in whichever kind of distorted and dangerous ways, that's something common to what everybody is looking for when they engage with these groups.
Yeah, it's exactly. That was something from those red-pilled women or the trad wives and female misogynists through to the neo-Nazis, the jihadists. They were essentially all looking, sometimes even for family replacements, for some sense of community, for some form of love in the end. It sounds like cheesy, but that's essentially what the conclusion was as well, that they were... and they were given that. Unfortunately, they were given that very... sometimes very easy solution to that. For example, in the red pill women community, they even gave you a feeling of kind of being a self-help forum or a counseling forum for women. And I think it's that what makes some of these movements so appealing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Okay, well, I think we're about out of time. But that is a very good, provocative and unsettling point to end on, I think. You know, thinking about, well, if people are being drawn to these kind of groups and they're finding that welcome or that community, well, why is that missing elsewhere?
Yeah.
So, I hope we can continue this kind of conversation at a later date. I'd like to thank Yulia again for writing the book, first of all, but for also coming here and talking to all of us about it. Thanks to the LRB Bookshop for hosting the event, and to everybody for coming. I hope you will stick around and take a look at the book afterwards, have a read, buy a copy, and then read it, think about it. That's what all authors want you to do, really. So for now, I'd just like you to join me in thanking Yulia for her
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.